We're going to talk about one of the most challenging things facing the country and the world, which is what's happening in the Middle East, what's happening in Iraq and Syria. And we have with us a very interesting and distinguished panel of people to wrestle with this. And we'll be also talking, by the way, tomorrow with Dr. Tabat Abdullah, who joins us many times. You could not join us live this morning because he's on Canadian TV. He's at York University, but we'll be joining us tomorrow for a commentary as well on Iraq. And we'll be covering this later in the week as things unfold. We are joined now by Matt Howard, Communications Director with the Iraq Veterans Against the War, who served in Iraq twice in the Marines. Matt, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Sam Faddis is with us. Sam Faddis is a retired CIA operations officer who also served in Iraq with the CIA before the war, author of many, many books. That's how we met him. His latest novel is Kaffa, and he writes all the time on the web and really interesting thinker. Sam, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Bill Fletcher is with us. He's racial justice, labor, and international activist, author of They're Bankrupting Us and 26 Other Myths About Unions. He's senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the immediate past president of the Trans-Africa Forum. Bill, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Dr. Richard Vatch is with us, professor of rhetoric and communication at Towson University's Department of Instructional Leadership and Professional Development and author of the recently released book, The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion. Good to have all four of you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
And the number here is 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com. And you can log on to our Facebook pages, or you can tweet us at Mark Steiner. But chiefs, join us with your ideas at 410-319-8888 with your thoughts and comments and ideas as we explore what's happening in Iraq with ISIS. And you know, I was going to start with Matt Howard. Matt, you served two tours of duty in Iraq, and the first thing we saw was the other month when ISIS took over Fallujah. But it's more complex than that. We'll get into that in a moment. But I'm curious as to your analysis of what you see happening, and if you saw it happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that as has been pointed out by a number of different people, by simplifying that it's ISIS or ISIL, whatever acronym you're using, that's come into Mosul and before that Fallujah, is really not appreciating the entire spectrum of resistance, basically, that's happening inside of Iraq. You have a lot of tribes, a lot of people that are completely alienated and outright oppressed by the Maliki regime. This has kind of become really a popular rebellion that ISIS is just the most organized at this point. Whether they continue to be the front runners or not, I think it remains to be seen. But, I think that in my time in Iraq, spent a lot of time with Iraqi laborers that came onto the forward operating base that I worked with. And, I think that, like many folks, they were just looking for a sense of security. And, in terms of Mosul, I think that there was a sense of security that at least temporarily was provided by ISIS as compared to, the Maliki regime, which has obviously not done that, especially with its Sunni citizens.
And Sam Faddis, I mean, this is something I think that is complex because, as many articles have pointed out recently, that what's happening now in Iraq is not something that happened overnight. This has been happening, and it's much more complex than just as we want to make good and evil terrorists versus good guys, Iran versus the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. It's so much more complex than this. And you were there in the very beginning before all this happened, even.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's clearly a very complex situation. I mean, what's happening with ISIS in northwestern Iraq is less about ISIS defeating the Iraqi army in the field and more about, the Iraqi army melting away and, quite frankly, large numbers of Sunnis deciding that they are so fed up with Maliki's government and fed up with what they regard as Shia rule that they're opting to give ISIS a chance. So it's not that ISIS is defeating and driving the Iraqi army before it. It's more that the Iraqi army is just vaporizing in front of it.
And Bill Fletcher, and we'll see what happens in the coming days with that, because Iran has got advisors inside of Iraq right now, and the army seems to be regrouping or the Iraqi army around the Shiite militias. We'll see how that plays out. But again, it's more complex than that. And Bill Fletcher, I'm glad you're here with us as well, and because it is more complex than this, And people, you know, we can play a partisan game here in America, Republicans blaming the Democrats, saying it's Obama's fault because we left too early, and we should be bombing now. But talk a bit about how you see this complexity.
United States has destroyed Iraq. I mean, I think we should start there. I mean, let's be very clear. The situation would not have unfolded had the U.S. not carried out its invasion in 2003. They knew exactly what they were doing. See, one of the things that we have to understand is that Bush, Cheney, and the rest of the gang understood in 2003 the ramifications of invading. And you may remember that immediately after the invasion and after the ouster of Hussein, there were discussions right then about dividing Iraq into three zones and three formal zones, you know, a Shia, a Sunni, and a Kurdish area. They understood what they were doing. What are the things about the Middle East that many people forget is that it was divided up in much the way that Africa was divided up by the Western colonial powers. And these states were created that were very complicated, had different ethnic and religious mixtures. But what we're looking at right now, contrary to what some of the media say, is not the result of a thousand-year conflict within Islam. It is specifically about the ramifications of the U.S. invasion in 2003.
Now, I think that's – I was going to come to that point. And Rick Vatz, we'll pick up on that, then we'll kind of get very specific on some of these issues. I just wanted to raise some broad thoughts from all of you first. But I think that a lot of this also can go – this is the Pandora's box that was opened when we first invaded Iraq.
Well, let me just say that, first of all, this is the first time I've ever been on your show in which I felt that the expertise of the subject at hand was so overwhelmingly in favor of the other guests. So let me stick to my own area, and that is persuasion. And I really think that Brent Scowcroft has pointed out that we may have made a mistake in going into Iraq, but Barack Obama has made a mistake in pulling out of Iraq. Barack Obama announces when we will leave, places what we won't do, and other actors act accordingly. Maliki is not afraid of him. ISIS is not afraid of him. Nobody is intimidated by this president. And that has geopolitical consequences. And you can say – you can do reductio ad absurdum and say the problem is our invasion. But the problem is multifold, and the problem is also due, again, to the president's complete lack of intimidation in international affairs.
Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we're looking at is, regardless, you know, obviously the occupation has destabilized things in a significant way. We're looking at, in some cases, a million citizens dead or by some accounts. We're looking at the kind of toxic legacy that's been left behind. I think that, you know, one of the things that we've kind of played out in our relationship building with Iraqi groups is that, you know, the democratic movements inside of Iraq, known as the Iraqi Spring, had received very little attention here in the U.S. And obviously there was very little support from our government at the time around that. And the way that the Maliki government treated this, and this is not as simplified as one sectarian group and another. This was really a kind of multi-tribal, multi-sectarian kind of movement. You're looking at people that were that wanted actual democratic representation, and the way that it was treated was anybody that was advocating for change was labeled a terrorist, which is not, you know, we're no strangers to how that plays out here, and they were put down very violently, in some cases murdered, lots of cases kidnapped, and tortured. I mean, so I think that really plays a huge role in the way that we're looking at this kind of destabilization right now. And I just wouldn't point, you know, I think that's both administrations are equally at fault in the way that both the sectarian tensions have been stoked and then the way that Maliki has been first propped up, the Constitution rewritten in a way that is inherently anti-labor, anti-women, basically, and then this kind of, you know, in a kind of a silent support, so to speak, for Maliki's actions.
I think that is a point that's really important here. Let me go to Bill and then Sam. I think that, that when we look at what's happening now, and I would take it out in some ways, Bill Fletcher, out of the out of the realm of partisan politics. Oh, it's Obama's fault because he left too early. It didn't, nobody's afraid of him. It's George Bush's fault because we started the war. It's American policy, period. From George Bush even before that to Ronald Reagan when he supported Saddam Hussein to what we did with al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, coming home to roost. This is a long period of kind of a Western diplomacy in that area that all is coming home now.
Oh, Mark, I mean, you're absolutely right. But let me just go one step further. This whole notion that the U.S. pulled out too early, I mean, just think about it like this. If somebody carries out a home invasion on your house, do you ask them to stay around to clean up the mess? I mean, if they carry out a home invasion and destroy your home, kill members of your family, do you say, oh, listen, since you're here, can you just stay around for a little while and make sure everything is settled? We carried out, let's be clear, we carried out an illegal act of aggression. This was not just, oh, we made a mistake, right? Oh, we broke it, now we own it. We carried out an illegal act of aggression. We have screwed up that country. So this whole notion that, well, we've got to stay in, that no one is afraid of Barack Obama, this is absolutely absurd. The point is that we don't need to be there. That is not our situation. If we want to help the people of Iraq, we should do that along with other regional partners. It is not a unilateral thing. It's not about waving our stick around. It is about working with regional partners, including with Iran and Saudi Arabia, but most importantly, with the forces within Iraq to come to a political settlement. This notion about let's show them the guns, I mean, let's get out of these John Wayne movies.
I mean, Sam Faddis, and I'd like to get you in here on this as well. I mean, because I think we're at a point where it's really difficult, I think, for most people who understand this area of the world to say this is what America can and should do. This is what the West could do because we're seeing the disintegration of what was historically these nations created in the Sykes-Picot line after World War I, and we're seeing it kind of all fall apart here. I mean, what's your notion of a response?
Well, Mark, look, I think that we can make a big stack of all of the issues that have led us to this in Iraq, you know, going back to Sunni Shia divisions and artificial creations post-World War I of nations in the Middle East. But here's the bottom line. I mean, every president inherits the world as it is when he sits down at the big desk. So, you know, we don't have the option of rolling this back and undoing these things. This is the reality. And unfortunately, as somebody who was a very staunch critic of the Bush administration by the time they left office, I would say that this president's basic hallmark is lack of engagement on any level. I mean, once he announces that we're not going to use conventional military force, apparently every other option is off the table. And starting, frankly, with Syria, which is where this fire is really burning from, we have sort of just watched that place disintegrate, and it is now turning rapidly into a struggle between Assad, Hezbollah, and Iran, and Sunni extremist groups.
And Syria was the one place in which the president announced that if chemical weapons were used, that would cross a line. And the one place where he draws a line, he doesn't follow through on that. I'm telling you that you can't make these kinds of inconsistent communications in foreign policy and have no consequences.
Not inconsistent, Mark. The point is that people in Britain and in the United States said very clearly, stay the heck out of Syria. Right? I mean, this idea that, are we dealing with Emperor Augustus? I mean, are we naive enough to think that some president simply can decide, I don't like what Assad is doing, the hell with it, let's blast him, right? That may have been the persona that George Bush had, but even he was constrained by certain things. The bottom line is that within Iraq, this is not about rolling things back. It's about rethinking the way we approach foreign policy, getting away from this John Wayne notion that we come into town and we start shooting up the bad guys.
I mean, I think that it's easy to say that, you know, that the United States should have jumped into Syria and go after whom in a situation that was very volatile and fluid. And now we're talking about going in and bombing who in Iraq and going after who. siding with al-Maliki and Iran, or siding with Saudi Arabia, who is pushing, who's fueling a lot of the money that fueling the crisis in Syria with their backing of the jihadists. I mean, there's a complexity here. It's not something to go, okay, let's carry a big stick and look bad.
That's right, but it's somewhat of a false dilemma, because if you're trying to stop Syria from using chemical weapons, that is not going into Syria and saying we shall not allow X behavior to happen, except with respect to chemical weapons, which is verboten.
Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that you're looking at in Syria in particular was this idea that, you know, ISIS wasn't even declared a terrorist organization until February of 2014. And as I understand it, there were some conservative politicians that were advocating that we be funding various, groups inside of there, similar to ISIS. And, you know, as we have seen in Mosul, those weapons very quickly have transferred over to those same forces. So, I mean, that whole situation is obviously not cut and dry. And I think, as Bill, pointed out, there was a popular, overall popular will against, what has kind of around the idea of going in and bombing. The idea of going in and bombing right now, for example, inside of Iraq, it's not like we're dealing with troop formations in the way that we did in World War II or before that. We're dealing with a very sparsely, situated people, which means that we go in and start doing airstrikes, we're going to have increasingly more civilian casualties, even more than the hundreds of thousands that, in large part were responsible for. I think that this idea also that we departed early and departed too soon is also not taking into account the fact that the Iraqi government voted unequivocally that they didn't want us there any longer. And the status of forces agreement was not signed, and the Obama administration was not willing to let service members be accountable to Iraqi courts. Why would they not want to sign this status of forces agreement? It might have to do with some of the massacres that happened inside of Iraq. So this idea that, it's one particular president or it's a weak president, I mean, I think it's kind of preposterous.
We got to take a very brief break. I'm going to come right back with our four guests and you at 410-319-8888 with very specific questions about where we are now and what we can expect for how the future may unfold. We are going out with Tupac. Is that right?
Yep.
Yes, that is Tupac. You can hear him now. I ain't mad at you. It's his birthday. Stay with us.
I ain't mad at you. Now we was once two brothers of the same kind, quick to approach a ghetto cutie with the same line. You was just a little smaller, but you still rolled. Got stretched to YA.
I could put my arm around every girl I see, but they'd all remind me of you.
Now, before we jump back to Iraq, I have to say one quick thing. That is the voice of the great Jimmy Scott, one of the greatest jazz singers of all time. And I remember when I discovered him, I just listened to him over and over again, have all his work he's ever done. He died at age 88. I think he died last week. They just announced it today. So we played that. Maybe we'll play another piece by him later, because Jimmy Scott was just one of the greats of all time with that incredible male falsetto voice. He was just unbelievable singer. So he left us at 88 years old.
I just want to say parenthetically, Mark, that you and I overlap on music about as much as we overlap on politics.
That was the voice of Rick Vatz, who is professor of rhetoric and communication at Towson University's Department of Instructional Leadership and Professional Development, author of the recently released The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion. Bill Fletcher, who is a racial justice, labor, and international activist, author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. He's senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, former president of Trans-Africa Forum. Sam Faddis is a retired CIA operations officer, author of numerous books, and his most recent novel is called CAFFA, C-A-F-F-A. Sam, by the way, is an incredible writer. Matt Howard, communications director of the Iraq Veterans Against the War, who served did two tours of duty in Iraq with the United States Marines in the American War with Iraq. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can also write to us at steinershow@gmail.com, log on to our Facebook pages, or tweet us at Mark Steiner. There's so many pieces here that I do want to kind of pull together for our listeners, because this is really complex, and we're going to see how this evolves and unravels in the coming weeks, perhaps even longer. But first of all, I think that Bill Fletcher, let me start with you, and then we'll go around the room. Mm-hmm. I think that we make a mistake when we look at the establishment media and their usual binaries of how they look at the world. It's terrorism versus counterterrorism. It's good versus evil. It's insurgency versus stability. And I'm trying to get here is the complexity of this, because I think that what Americans are trying to figure out as well is how do we respond to it? Is there a response from the United States given what's unfolding now, and not the simplistic notion of good versus evil?
You know, this is one reason that I love this show, Mark. I think that you're really hitting on some central pieces. And actually, what you're raising here relates to an issue that came up the last show that I was on. Part of what the U.S. public needs to get is the historical background to what's going on in Iraq in order to formulate policies that make any degree of sense. If you have no historical context, if you don't understand the way in which Shia Sunni looks in Iraq, Not in Syria, not in Lebanon, but in Iraq. If you don't understand that, then you come up with bad policies. If you don't understand what one of your guests mentioned in the very beginning about the multi-level existence of this uprising, that it's not just about one particular terrorist insurgency, but that it's a complexity that's going on there, you come up with bad policies. I mean, that's why the point that was made was so good about if you start bombing, who are you going to bomb, right? I mean, and now we're talking about the intervention of Iran. Iranian Revolutionary Guards may already be on the ground. At least one Iranian has already been killed. So we've got to present this in a way so that regular people get it. This is not just about pushing a button on a video game.
And so, Sam, I know you said we are where we are now, and history is what it is, but of course history made us what we are now. I'm curious your thoughts on what that means about where we go from here, given those complexities, because we all remember the long Iraq-Iran war that took place. There was nothing the West could do to intervene in that either. So what do you say, what's your sense of where you go, where we go?
Well, look, there's a million layers to this, and there is nothing easy about any choice. It's complicated, it's difficult, and there are downsides. We have gone from sort of a neocon policy of thinking that we're going to solve everything directly by occupation and this so-called nation building to a policy of basically sitting on the sidelines saying that it's really hard and complicated, mm-hmm. and therefore we've made ourselves irrelevant in the process. So to begin with, we need to get off the sidelines in Syria. We sit around talking about arming moderate groups. Well, moderate groups don't magically appear. When you're in a gunfight, you take guns from whoever's going to give them to you. At this point, that is rapidly boiling down to a choice between being on the side of Iran, Assad, and Hezbollah, or being on the side of psychos like ISIS on the other side, because we are not present. We are making the situation worse by sitting on the sidelines and not being involved at all.
So and Matt, as someone who was in the middle of our nation-building involvement, so in sitting on the sidelines, if we're not sitting on the sidelines, then what are we doing? What should we be doing?
We should have been in Syria 3 years ago.
This is Sam saying that, right.
I don't mean conventionally. I mean we should have been involved heavily in supporting and backing and arming groups 3 years ago.
Matt?
Yeah, I can't speak as confidently to Syria, but I do think that the idea that we just need to get back right in the mix is, I think that we do need to get back in the mix, and I think that we can do that in diplomatic means. I think that we can pressure our allies in Saudi Arabia that know very well who's funding ISIS. I think that we can put pressure on Iran to figure out some way that we that there can be some sort of reconciliation. Granted, you know, ISIS doesn't seem like it's going to be reasoned with very well, but I think that I think that there's whether it's partition or whatever it looks like, some sort of federalist situation, I think that there are options available. It's granted, it's not very easy and it's not very good, but our tendency towards military solutions, if it hasn't been proven wrong yet, I don't know what is. The folks inside of ISIS met each other inside of American prisons. They got their training on the battlefield inside of Iraq. We were told we were going to go in to find weapons of mass destruction, and then Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda didn't exist in Iraq, but they sure did once we got there. And then if we even look at Afghanistan, who are we fighting right now? We're fighting the people that we trained in the 70s. So there's, the amount of blowback, the amount of opportunity we have to shoot ourselves in the foot over and over again, it kind of seems awe-inspiring to me that our first solution is that, well, obviously we just got to go there and start bombing people.
Yeah. So let me just, before you jump in, Rick, let me just say this, that throw this other point in here that adds the complexity of this, because we're going to do many programs on the history of what led up to this, because I really want people to understand this and explore it from the 19th century to this point where we are now, because we have to understand our history and understand where the future might go. But if you look at what could possibly happen right now, you can see the unraveling of the state of Iraq, which means that there could be a mostly Shia-dominated entity in the southeastern part of Iraq where most of the oil is, and this stretch, this swath between western Syria and northern Iraq falling under ISIS or wherever that might be, and they can see them also having internal warfare eventually between the Ba'athists and tribal leaders and this group ISIS, however we want to call this Islamic Caliphate of Iraq and Syria. When you see Kurdistan, its troops, the Peshmerga, are ready and lining up for battle. They're preparing for it. They're in some of it now. That independent Kurdistan sense could happen. And then that would mean Turkey would be very nervous. And who knows what that could mean in regard to that. If it is, in fact, a kind of new nationalist state in Iraq that is mostly Shia, and most of northwestern Saudi Arabia, where the oil is mostly Shia, that would then kind of identify with that nationalism, possibly. And of course, we can't leave out Iran. So I'm saying that when you look at all this, Bill Fletcher, this is a very complex thing that's happening, because the lines that were built in 1917, 1918, are unraveling, and this unraveling is what we don't know how to stop, nor where it's going to go.
No, that's very true, and it is a situation. Going back to this issue of regional solutions, that the role of the U.S. and I realize that this is very uncomfortable for many people in the United States, because we're very much trained as a settler country that you resolve things through whoever has the biggest guns. And so I appreciate that. I understand that that's the impulse of many of our policy people. We've got the big guns, so damn it, let's go in and blow the hell out of people and just resolve the matter at the end of the day and have a beer. The role of the United States in this region could be incredibly productive if it is prepared to work with the various regional powers there to deal with the perceived and real threats that the different countries actually feel and experience. It's not going to be resolved by sending arms into Syria, sending troops into Syria, threatening Assad. I mean, there are behind-the-scenes discussions, as happened before with Russia, that could have an impact on what happens in Syria. The negotiations with Iran around nuclear power could in fact be expanded and help to resolve the larger situation. Why are we not thinking at that level? Why do we take each individual crisis and handle it by itself? And then why, when we become frustrated, do we think, best thing to do is send in the drones.
Well, let me just say that I mean I identify with Sam's arguments and with Matt's arguments, and I think that one of the concerns is, but I don't know who's arguing for troops. I mean, I haven't heard any major actor who was arguing that we should send in troops.
Well, we are holding out the option of airstrikes or drone strikes.
Yeah, that's exactly correct.
Right.
And now here's one of the things that I'd love to hear some of the reaction of Sam in particular is the recommendation by Lindsey Graham that somehow Maliki has to go, that he has been so prejudicial against the Sunnis that he has energized ISIS, and that is a critical component. I understand this is multifarious, but that is a multifaceted, but that is a critical component of the problem.
He has – well, Sam, you can jump in there, but my question would be he has to go. I mean, once again, the United States is going to say that an election that we supported is no longer valid, so Maliki has to go, and it's our job to get rid of him. Sam?
Well, I don't know exactly what we're talking about when we're talking about getting rid of him. I mean, obviously, I don't think we're suggesting that we're going to do something extra legal and literally expose him. But I agree that Maliki is at a minimum. I mean, he's not created the problem from the ground up, but he's certainly pouring fuel on the fire. I mean, this is why Sunnis are walking away from their jobs in the army and the security services in front of ISIS, because they're literally deciding that this is a better option than continuing to live under the rule of a guy that they think is 100% in support of the Shia only.
Right, that's the argument. That's the argument.
But you know, look, when you make yourself irrelevant, when you're no longer represented on the ground, when you're not bringing anything to the fight in any sense, and I'm not talking conventional forces, well, then you pretty much don't have any capacity to dictate events. And you know, in terms of leaning on regional powers, we can go talk to the Saudis all you want. But what the Saudis are going to say is that this is rapidly boiling down to a fight between Sunni and Shia Muslims. And there's no way in hell we're watching Iran and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps go in there and backing away from support of Sunni elements. You guys are not here. You're not doing anything. We're going to solve this our way, which is by arming Sunni extremists.
Matt Howard, I think this, but what Sam is describing is probably not too far wrong, though what I worry about, what my friend Rick was just saying a moment ago, is the United States is getting a very bad reputation around the world of kind of trying to topple elected governments that we don't agree with, whether it's Ukraine or Iraq, even though we might not like either one of those corrupt governments, we're starting to do that. But Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I don't, I wouldn't pretend to know all of the diplomatic options available to us. I know that with Syria, an imperfect diplomatic solution emerged that probably many analysts weren't even considering as a possibility. I also know that we essentially disarmed the Sunnis inside of the Baghdad area, and they were proceeded to be massacred by Mahdi Army and other Shia militia groups. So to say that they might have a bone to pick with us is an understatement. And if we go around and we start bombing who we're calling ISIS, but is also a popular resistance, coalition of militias and other Sunni groups inside of Mosul, inside of Fallujah, it's going to appear that we've yet again taken that particular side, which seems like a pretty good opportunity to create yet more radicalized and angry populations, not at Maliki, but at the United States. And as going back to my original point about blowback, this seems like yet another opportunity for us to create a situation of blowback.
And I think we have to also, what you're saying to add to that, Matt, that makes the complexity of what's going on now with ISIS, however we want to frame the name of the group, the Islamic Caliphate of Iraq and Syria, is that just before this occurred, there was something you described earlier, Matt, which I want to reiterate, which was the Iraqi Spring, which were Shias and Sunnis and others throughout Iraq having nonviolent protests around the election, around corruption, around rebuilding the country, around putting Iraq back as a place people live together, and that many of the people in Fallujah and Mosul who were in those demonstrations have now picked up guns to fight alongside of ISIS, even though many of them are secular, because of what's what Maliki did. That's what I'm talking about, the complexity of what we're watching.
Absolutely. I mean, they were radicalized. You look at Hawija, where they brought in tanks, and they essentially crushed people. I mean, literally with tanks, crushed people. Obviously, this is not widely known. It's not talked about because it doesn't serve
right.
the narrative of Maliki as a legitimate force.
Right.
And it wasn't covered much by the American establishment press either. I mean, you didn't see the news of that, though I followed it through the British news and other news around and the French news and some Arabic news, but you saw that. But we didn't even cover this country at all, and that is part of what led to here, which is why we're in such a difficult place trying to figure out what the response should be. And I think that's, again, we keep going back to that, Bill, and I'll go to Sam, because, I think that Americans are watching this unfold. And Americans are seeing a war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan that took all these years and American lives and Iraqi and Afghan lives. And people are, I think, in a quandary. I mean, people who are established hard in the right wing are going to blame Obama, and some people are going to just put it all on George Bush. But we've got to figure out how to wrestle with this more deeply in this country to figure out what it is we're doing here. I don't think anybody knows.
No, I think that you begin with that statement. That we begin with that statement, that nobody really knows. And when you begin with that admission of ignorance, you can go forward and actually can learn. And that's one of the problems. You know, one of the things I get such a kick out of in the United States is that we really don't like history. And we don't really believe in it. Our attitude is, it doesn't matter what happened in the past. We don't have to worry about the past. Let's just go forward. And that's one of the things that keeps getting us into all kinds of trouble. The situation there is not going to be resolved by Obama or anyone else exerting some sort of alleged authority. I mean, the reality is, if we want to get the Saudis in the room, you can't tell me that the United States can't get the Saudis in the room. The Saudis, who have no effective army, right, who have no effective military, you can't tell me the Saudis that have depended on the U.S. since the 1940s, that the U.S. cannot get them in the room? I mean, you know, if you believe that, I've got a bridge for you to buy in New York, and I can get it for you cheap. I mean, the reality is we know how to approach these folks. We talked to the Russians and worked out the agreement for the withdrawal of chemical weapons, or the beginning of the process of the withdrawal of chemical weapons from Syria. We know how to do these things. It is not that we simply have to send in the drones or send in the F-16s. I mean, as Matt was pointing out, I think it was Matt, the problem is that the U.S. helped to incite the Sunni-Shia struggle in the aftermath of the invasion. We have to take some responsibility for that. And when we think about sending in military operations to deal with this, as was pointed out, who are we going to be firing at? Who's the target? You know, and what happens if the Iranians get in the bullseye? I just think that there's a level of this that is just absolutely absurd.
Sam?
Well, let me take this angle, Mark. The stakes here are enormous, okay, because this is not an obscure struggle that's going on somewhere, and it may be a humanitarian disaster, but it doesn't have much to do with us. This is a maelstrom that is forming right in the heart of the Middle East. And on one way this breaks, you are going to have a new Afghanistan, pre-9/11 Afghanistan, in the heart of the Middle East. The other way it breaks, Iraq is going to emerge as a complete client state of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And, you can getting the Saudis in the room is not the problem. Getting the Saudis to agree to something relevant is the problem. And they are pragmatists, and they practice realpolitik. And they are at war, as far as they're concerned, with Shia Islam, and have been for a long time. And asking them to exercise restraint when you're not offering a hard-nosed, practical solution is not going to get you any place. I mean, the Saudis have been publicly talking about for months now the necessity to begin to consider the possibility that they and the Gulf states need to acquire a nuclear weapons capability. from their perception, we are getting ready to let the Iranians have the ball. Now, I'm not suggesting that's Barack Obama's intention or that's where his policy is. I'm saying that's their perception of our policy and where things stand. And it gives you an idea of how close to a precipice we are.
And so, Matt, I mean, do you also, someone who's been there and back and understands analytically that we're at this precipice?
I mean, without a doubt, I think we're at a juncture around what decision-making, what decisions are made, right? I mean, if we decide to, I mean, it doesn't sound like boots on the ground are an option. Who knows if there's enough bane, maybe that will be the case. You know, it seems like, based off of things that I've read recently, Iran and the U.S. are in the midst of talking to each other, kind of as we speak, around what they, you know, what kind of negotiations they need to do. I think that if we decide to draw ourselves into yet more of this conflict, it's going to be really indefinite as to how long we're in Iraq or involved in Iraq. I think that we're looking at, I think that kind of the point that was made around kind of this, you know, having something concrete to offer Saudi Arabia actually requires the political will to figure out what that means.
I'm sorry, Matt.
No, and just, you know, if there's not any interest in figuring out what that could look like, and there's not, you know, you don't put enough of the brain trust behind that to figure it out, then of course we're going to resort immediately to kind of military solutions.
I mean, and I'll let you jump in here, Rick, but we only have a couple minutes left. Let me just add this because then you can come right and close it out. We must have some leverage of the Saudis in this because all throughout the Gulf, the Emirates and Saudi Arabia, the places where the oil is, and if it's in fact becoming a Sunni-Shia split, the places where the oil is under the ground, the population is majority Shia, not Sunni. And so, there is leverage on the part of the U.S. to kind of try to negotiate between this and Iran and Saudi Arabia. And that would be, to me, the strongest way America could go right now, not playing the big stick, but playing, we've got to get this resolved.
On a slightly optimistic note, yesterday, the Iranian foreign minister had an article in either the Washington Post or the New York Times that was, in fact, fairly confident about the ability of the United States and Iran to work out a nuclear agreement. But I also say that one of the things that strikes me when I hear these very, very learned conversations is a lack of concern about short-term versus long-term solutions. I mean, the fact is that we have to look at long-term stability. You know, short-term, we can talk about ISIS. You know, a week ago, we weren't talking about ISIS. I'm just saying that we have to look at the considerable importance of long-term solutions, not short-term solutions.
I do want to thank – do we have time left for one more thought here? Yes, very quick thought from Bill Fletcher before we have to go. Bill?
No, I actually agree with that last point and the last 2 points. I think that that's absolutely the way to be thinking about this, that there's a number of these powers that are looking – they're looking for solutions. And the question is whether the U.S. – and it doesn't have to be done. This is not going to be something that's going to be done on ABC News. But whether or not the U.S. can absolutely sit down with these forces quietly and begin the discussions of potential regional solutions.
Well, I want to thank all four of you for being here. This has been a really good conversation, and I'm glad our listeners had a chance to hear all of you. Bill Fletcher just heard, Racial Justice Labor International activist, author of Their Bankruptness, 20 Other Myths About Unions, is a senior scholar at the Institute of Policy Studies. Rick Fatz here in the studio, professor at Towson University, author of the book The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion. Sam Faddis, numerous books. Latest is Kaffa. We will link to his website and all of his work on our website, steinershow.org. And to continue reading what he's been writing, and Matt Howard, Communications Director for Iraq Veterans Against the War, and who did two tours in Iraq. Thank you so much, all four of you, for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity.
We're going to take a very brief break. And when we come back, we're going to meet Charles Lawler, who is running to become the Republican nominee for governor. Stay with us.